Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the British Film Designers Guild, and last weekend I was proud to present the Production Design Awards for 2021 for films released last year. While I was there, I spoke to four creatives working in art departments in the UK about their work. You're about to hear from Blair Barnett, the incoming BFDG chairperson, production designer and set decorator Lilia Abraham, production designer Peter Francis, and supervising art director Peter Russell, who this year won the Lifetime Achievement Award.
My name is Blair Barnett. I'm a production designer and art director. I've been working in the film business for nigh on 35 years in almost every single capacity, but now it's chiefly square in design. Well, my favorite thing that I've done is a very little known dark comedy called Sightseers, which is one of my favorite cult films, if I might say so myself, even though I worked on it. I've worked on Heroes. I did a lot of Nickelodeon projects, Sesame Street. So I go from kids TV to horror and everything in between. It's just what I like.
Let's talk a bit about Sightseers, because I'm a huge fan of Ben Wheatley's. I did a piece with Ben for the Culture Show when Sightseers came out. And we shot it out in a caravan in a field, because it was like that was our idea of production design. What does production designing a film like Sightseers involve?
Oh, gosh. It was also twee. And I was the art director on that. Janie Levick was the production designer, who's fantastic. It was all kind of lo-fi and handmade and quintessentially English.
Okay.
So we wanted to bring that element to it, not make it slick and glossy and Americanized and Hollywood like a lot of films do. They want this hyper reality brought into films, and that's not how things are. We didn't want kitchen sink in the Mike Lee realm, but we wanted it to definitely be very English. So we put, even the locations like the Pencil Museum and the Crouch Tramway Museum. I mean, these are all things, tourist destinations that aren't like Universal's Islands of Adventure. It was just like cute little things. So we wanted all of the production design to be on that level. Lots of storytelling, lots of allegory, lots of bringing in things like little Easter eggs for us to discover later on in the show. But it all was multi-layered and just very English.
Chris, Poppy's stopping. Poppy's stopping, Chris. Yeah, good girl. Oh, you have a little foe.
Excuse me. You are going to pick that up.
Well, I haven't. Chris.
This is a site of natural beauty and geographical interest. I think you need to sort that out.
I didn't do that.
You need to pick it up.
I can't.
Why can't you?
Well, I haven't got the proper things to do.
Why didn't you bring the proper things with you if you're out with your dog?
Well, I did bring the proper things, but I'm not having a very good day. Chris.
Good morning.
Please tell me I'm going to pick that up with my fingers.
The designer is the one who just walks into a room and knows exactly how to take the pages from words on the script from words on a page to a fully functioning set that everybody can use, cameras can fit into, people can go in and out. They're brilliant. The art director is kind of the muscle behind it. We look at this crazy vision that we've been given. Okay, right, you want the moon on a stick. Well, the moon is going to require a huge crane, and the stick needs to be made out of titanium. We need 15 guys for that. It's going to take 3.5 weeks, and we needed to start yesterday. So that's what our direction does, is they'll figure it out. They're the engineers of making that happen. When we're doing our job at our best, nobody notices, because what we've created is so natural, so intrinsic to the film, the storytelling that you're so absorbed in, that you don't notice somebody's put it there. It's like it's an aura of the character itself, or that house just arrived. We walked up and the house was like that. We basically make everything look natural, or completely unnatural if you want it to be, you know, science fiction or something outrageous. But we tried to make a seamless transition between it didn't exist and now it's perfect on the screen. And if you're not working there with us, of course you attribute that to who's pointed the camera at it, or who's directed, or what the actor has done. But sometimes it's none of those things. It's the environment as a whole, and it's a very intangible process. But if you don't notice it, that means that we've done it correctly.
What the hell do you think you're doing? I'm telling a complete stranger intimate details about us.
Not about us. It's about me.
It's about us!
The first thing that made me realize that production design was a job was the cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover. When I saw that film come out and I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is a great story. It's just, hang on, that room was red, and what's going on with her hat? And wait a minute, I call shenanigans. What's happening? This isn't real. This isn't a real place. And it made me realize someone's done that on purpose in order to tell a story, and in order to basically, you know, make it as unusual and as eccentric as the story was itself. We were taken on a visual journey, and color was the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And that blew my mind at the time. I'm like, I want that job. That's what I need to be doing. And that was like, something like that is really recognizable. But you don't get all of those stories. A lot of times it's real life, and real life is hard to put your finger on.
His mother is a Roman Catholic. He's been in prison in South Africa, and he probably drinks his own pee.
I'm stepping up to be the chair of the British Film Designers Guild, which it's kind of hard to say what that role is, but it's a group of people that we consider ourselves to be some of the best in the industry, people who are coming up into the industry. We represent some of the best filmmaking that's made. I mean, some of the best filmmaking that's ever been made happens here in Britain, which is why I moved here from Hollywood to be part of that class. And I'm stepping up to basically help some underrepresented people come, other voices come. It's a big, broad world, and there's so much divisiveness that's happening right now. We need to hear other voices, and we need to hear different things. I mean, the world needs more storytelling. I mean, we are the ones who make the films that we watched during a pandemic, when we watched literally everything there was to be made. That's what kept people from going crazy. I really want to be able to contribute what I've learned in my life, and as a traveler, I've traveled around the world, and I've just seen so many different things, and I want to bring that kind of flavor to the Guild, and to help other people who might not have had a voice before get into it, and get into the industry in general, because it's hard unless, you know, you can afford to take a month and a half or 2 years and a half off and not get paid and work as a runner. It's really hard to get into the industry, and there's something that needs to happen to be able to help other people come in, and I really want to be able to help make that process.
There's a move in the awards this year to be more diverse, to include more categories, and also to deal with the fact that there is a skill set shortage, that you know, that there are not as many practitioners as we need. How does the industry need to develop in order to address the challenges of the immediate future?
Well, there's a pedanticness that happens, and we all strive for the best, right? That's just human nature. We all want the perfect person. And this industry makes it very hard for anybody to make a mistake. It's very unforgiving for anybody to make any kind of flub up.
You mean because if you do, you're out?
Yeah, if you do, you're out. Also, if you do, you just cost a lot of money. Right. Or you do and, you know, someone yells at you. It could be as simple as that. But for all of those reasons, we're all under these great amount of pressures to be able to make everything perfect. In order to do that, it's hard to have faith and it's hard to take risks. So you hire the same people over and over and over again because they've done you well in the past and you know they're going to do you well again. And this other person you've not met, maybe the best person in the world, but you're not going to hire them because it's on you if they fail. And I mean, that's basically in a nutshell what I see happening. So it's just having those opportunities and making, and it's not telling people, oh, take a chance on this person, but finding a way to merge that person into an already thriving industry by having more trainee roles, mm-hmm. having more support roles, more shadowing, to having productions be able to make room for other people who aren't churning out 250%, which is what they expect from all of us. They've even joined up roles with things that you used to be able to spread out and like have mindfulness and take considered actions. You can't do that anymore now. You have to make a decision, run with it, and you better hope it works. So there's not as much space for apprenticeship and trainee and mentoring anymore.
So you talk about apprenticeship roles being hard to come by. Did it used to be the case that the industry was more welcoming, or is it that it has always been quite hard and that you're looking towards a new future that we haven't had yet?
I think it's a little from column A and a little from column B, but more so the latter. When I was starting in the industry, I found that nobody really wanted to give you a hand. Everybody was so scared about their job that, I mean, I got to where I am through a series of fantastic mishaps. If there was a mistake to be made, I made it. And I owned it. And, you know, and I just moved on from it. But, and I didn't have really much mentorship. But my first foray into it was as a scenic artist. A painter. Mm-hmm. And in that capacity, there really was. In order for me to get into the union and become where I was and be able to even be allowed to hold a paintbrush, which is very much a thing, you can't touch the brushes until you get to a certain age or a certain level in your career. I'm not joking. But there were, you would sit with people and you would work with people. And like for a whole year, all I did was pick up the brushes of other artists and wash them out properly and take care of them and learn how to do that. A whole year of that. And nowadays, people don't have the time for that or the patience for that. Like they get their first job in the industry and then they want to be the boss. But I think that is a lot to do with the fact of how the industry is. They expect everybody to just snap to it and be instantly a professional. And that's just not how things are. You know, it's a craft and we need time to become craftsmen. And there needs to be that opportunity again, at least for where I was as a scenic across all the other boards. I can't speak from experience how it worked in production or cinematography or in design. But the only way to make professionals is to nurture and grow them. You can't expect somebody to just jump up and become a professional.
Is there a lot of talent available?
God, yes. I mean, the skill sets are, I mean, even like you look at like a waiter, you know, and what they have to do to have to balance things. They have to know their customers. They have to memorize things. They have to work under pressure. They have to get up really early and stay really late and keep everything happening. A lot of plates in the air, no pun intended. Those sort of skill sets really will do you great on set, because it's not even so much the skills, the technical skills of operating what you're doing. That's part of it. But it's having that dance and having that wherewithal to be able to deal with the high-pressure post-deadline situation that is filmmaking. And not everybody has the graft. And it's not even saying that you have graft like there's something wrong with you. There has to be something kind of wrong with you to be able to deal with it. Do you know? It's not natural. And it's you know, you have to be tough as nails to be able to do it. And a lot of jobs that aren't filmmaking develop those skills. So you can take just that personality and learn to do something in the industry if you have that personality. But it's being able to find that talent, see that talent and pluck it out and give those people opportunities and grow them to be able to work in the industry. That's where we need to do it.
And if people hearing this thought, well, look, this sounds like something I'm interested in, what are the routes into the industry?
Well, there's it's becoming more and more now. There are organizations like Talking Point and Skillset that will take you and mentor and help you. You can join clubs, like, or you can join the guild. You can start something as a newcomer and join, and somebody will help you personally on a personal level. There's Facebook groups out there where you can just join the Facebook group and watch the things that are being said. There's Mandy.com and other organizations where you can work for free on someone's student film or just a passion project. I mean, that's the best. If you could afford to take a couple of weeks off and put yourself into that situation, that's like boot camp. That's like a whole year of university working on one short film. So it's those opportunities. You kind of have to, there's not like a clinical way in. You know, it's not so formulated. There's no like syllabus for learning to be it, which is part of the problem, I feel. There are training courses and degrees in filmmaking. Not everybody can afford that. Yeah. And it also doesn't really show you what happens on set.
And they're also very hard to get into with very,
Absolutely.
Very limited places.
For sure.
Two last things. What's the greatest achievement of the last year in terms of production, and what's the greatest challenge of the next year?
Oh my goodness. The greatest achievement of the last year was how all of a sudden everyone and their grandmother is a master filmmaker. Like I said, we devoured and consumed everything that could possibly be watched during the first year of the pandemic. And we ran out of stuff to watch. And then all of a sudden, everybody needs box sets. Everybody needs to binge watch. Everybody needs everything to take their mind off of this crazy planet implosion that we're having right now. And somehow or another, we quadrupled output worldwide. I've never seen anything like it. It started off with like a certain amount of studios, and then you had streaming television. But now, there's just, it's coming out of the woodwork. If you want to make a film, you're hard pressed to not be able to make a film these days. And somehow or another, it's all good. It's like, it's not all of it. I'm telling a movie critic here. He's going to say it's not all good, but it's all accomplished filmmaking in some capacity. And we haven't built new cameras or made new Luton trucks or grown new people. Somehow or another, we've taken what we have, we've made that work, and churned out an output that's mind-boggling. And moving forward, what we need to do is be able to do that in a sustainable way without burning people out, wasting materials, ruining what we've got, and lessening the quality. We've got a big shoes to fill, I should say, in being able to keep up this pace, or at least keep up the quality, the production value of what we're doing, because we don't want to go back to watching crappy TV, do you know, or three channels, do you know. That'll never happen. It's just going to grow. It's just going to go on, do you know, from here. So we need to find a way to be able to keep that sustainable, and we haven't touched on keeping things green or making things not wasteful. And the filmmaking business is one of the most wasteful industries. And that's another thing I'm trying to do, is find out ways to be able to do that without being so negative to the planet and humanity.
I studied film in high school and I watched Fallen Angels by Wong Kar-wai. And I was saying, What the hell is this? It's so incredible. And then I was to study economy, and my film teacher in high school said, you can't study economy, you need to study film. And then I moved to London, I started studying film, and now I'm here. My name is Dililia Abraham, and I won the award for best production design in short film for Catch a Butcher.
What does it mean to win that award?
It means incredibly much, because we all worked on this short film beside our full-time jobs in the art department, and to be recognized in this format is just incredible. So many of us work on short films, and many times they just miss, you know, the production designer because we don't have much budget. On that level, you know, people cannot create those very amazing things, mm-hmm. or very high quality things. But once we get recognized for when we manage to achieve it, it means terribly much. Whole filmmaking is about teamwork and communication, and have one visual concept which everybody can thrive to. This is filmmaking, that's why we are doing it.
Do you enjoy it?
I do enjoy it very much, but you need to be a bit crazy.
In what way?
You need to be obsessed, I think, to do filmmaking, obsessed with storytelling, with visual storytelling, and just always wanting to do better and go further and work with more and more creative people. So this is not for the faint-hearted. And I love that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Peter Russell, and I'm a supervising art director.
So the Lifetime Achievement Award is, you know, the sort of pinnacle of the awards. Tell me what you, when you look at the lifetime of work, what are you most proud of? What are the things that stand out for you in your career?
Good question. I think longevity, in a sense. By that, I probably mean. There was a period of a learning curve for all of us, and we're very lucky that there is time and positions in the department where you can actually, I would say, ally experience to more responsibility. And then eventually you become, you know, like a hybrid creature. And my particular role as supervising art director is kind of halfway between the department and then above me as the designer. The reason that maybe I've been given this award is just generally I got it. I understand my role and try to execute it to the best I can.
You make it sound very practical. You make it sound like...
I've always assumed that the practicality starts with me. And that's, you know... There's a moment on any design process where you can have, you know, 62,000 million brilliant ideas, of which all but three of them will eventually trip us up. the skill is to make everyone else aware of that problem and make it their idea that they go with, you know, the ideas that can work.
So is the sort of fundamental core of the trade the intersection between art and practicality?
There's a moment, definitely. You can't differentiate the two, but yes, there is. There's sort of blue sky thinking, and then there's 250 tradesmen waiting to start bashing bits of wood together. And that interface is a moment. From a production point of view, it starts when the money starts going out the door as well. Yeah. So we try and make sure we're on the right path.
I'm Peter Francis, I'm a production designer. As a production designer, I rely heavily on my supervising art director, because they really make it work for you. And if you've got a supervising art director who has your back, if you like, and knows what you like and knows what you want to achieve, they're the most important person to me, actually, personally, because I find that reassurance that there's somebody there just tapping on reality and making sure that what we want to achieve is doable. Because at the end of the day, time and money is what it comes down to. So as a supervising art director, you know, you have to be really on the money and on the time and on the practicalities and realise what is achievable in the time you have for the money you have. So it does come down to nuts and bolts like that, actually. You know, there's the wonderful creative bit where we all think up amazing ideas, and then those ideas have to be put into practice.
They have to fit in a box. Boxes.
One of the reasons I came into the art department was because out in the real world, as I call it, you know, you had to. It's so complicated. You can't build stuff like we build stuff. You know, we build things very quickly, and you can build pretty well whatever you like because it doesn't have to stand up and have building regulations. I mean, the rules are a lot stricter now, but you know, it's a fantasy world, and we're creating an illusion. So we're, you know, as a supervising art director, Peter's there to make sure that whatever the production designer wants to do, and the director wants to do, of course, as well, happens, and gets everyone on the same page. That's really important as well, actually. And one of the things I think the most important aspect of any film that you make is teamwork, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, we're all there. I always find it amazing that you get people from all different walks of life, every different trade. We're all there to produce the same product at the end of the day, the film and the vision. And it's always fascinates me how, you know, from an electrician on the stage to a rigger to a director to a first assistant director to a costume designer, everybody's there. We've all got our own sort of aim that we're heading for, don't we? But yeah. As a team, we all come together, and especially in the art department, you know, you've got to have a strong team, and then it works.
I remember the first time I ever went on a movie set, the thing that surprised me most, and this is just, you know, it was ignorance on my part, because I'd been writing about films, because I'd been watching films, but I'd never been on a set. And I went on a set, and I thought, this is a building site. This literally looks like a construction site, because, of course, that is what most of it is. For anyone who isn't familiar with this, it's correct to say that essentially the production designer would imagine the world, and the art director would go, okay, I will actually physically make that possible. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, to a degree. I mean, I don't think you can actually, because, you know, production designers are quite often, you know, incredibly experienced technicians in their own right.
Right.
So, unless you're playing some hideous game, you know, when a designer suggests something, it's pretty sensible. There are other aspects that can, you know, we need to fine tune it. But in essence, it's seldom that someone comes in and goes, we're going to make this out pink blancmange, what does anyone think? So, you know, but, you know, going back to what we said, usually a designer's early design time turns, the heat on that turns up slightly when someone like me arrives, followed by the start of 18, 20, 24 people all clamouring after their time to try and take that essence and convert it originally into a model, into drawings, documentation, however it is that we can transpose those thoughts down to a workshop and start actually, you know, giving it substance.
Yeah. But the pink blancmange is the exciting bit. I mean, that's where we all go, and then the thought process comes in. You know, you've come up with you've discussed something with the idea. The director just said something and you picked up on it and you sort of, you know, think, oh, that's interesting. And then you start thinking about it and you start trying to figure out how you can do it. Stuart Craig was brilliant at this. He would always find something that's not in the script or that's not quite there, and he'd pick it out and everyone would go, whoa, okay, all right. And then the thought starts, and then we start talking about how to do it. How can we possibly do this? How can we make this idea work? And then, you know, that then comes down to models, sketches, you know, trying to figure it out. Lots of talking, lots of people figuring it out. And you know, everybody, I listen to everybody because you never know who's got a better idea. Do you know what I mean? And you just, and you work it out amongst yourselves. And then, yes, and then it's like, gets down to the practical point of view and you're like, okay, right, well, we think we can do it. And then, you know, we look at it again. And then the art of the art department, which is so amazing, is that we do make it work. We do create that blancmange out of nothing, you know, sometimes, which is an incredible thing, you know. And, you know, you walk onto a set and it's still, the hairs on the back of my neck still go up when I walk on and the set's there and you just think, wow, this is fantastic. We built this in 3 weeks or whatever it is, you know. And, but I think you always have to have the blancmange because you have to, we always aim higher than we can possibly go. And then reality, and then, you know, it sort of works its way through and yeah.
Okay, because I love this analogy, because it's something that I can understand. What's the most pink blancmange moment you've ever had when somebody has said to you, I want this?
No, I've still got years in the industry left, I'm not saying that. Usually
comes to the director first, though, the pink blancmange.
Yeah, no, that's, no, yeah, exactly that. Yeah, it's not a win. No. It's actually a... I would think... Probably, and it's something we haven't touched on, it's probably another aspect, but not enough time. Mm. You know, we would have these heartfelt, meaningful discussions, designs would be made, and we look at the calendar and go, well, in 3 weeks. To me, that's the, you know, that's the difficult part, I think.
It's the difficult part, yeah. But amazingly, quite often, because we have such amazing crews and technicians, quite often we do it. That's always, that amazes me even more.
Yeah.
When we actually do, we think, is it possible? And then we go, God, it's tight. But it always happens. It always works. And even if it's not exactly the biggest pink blancmange, it's the smaller one, it happens. It's incredible.
Blair was just saying that looking forward in the industry, that thing about time and money being able to be available, because obviously those are the two rarest commodities, and specifically time. And she was saying that, you know, there's been so much content produced. During lockdown, we've all consumed absolutely avidly. Are we going to be in a position in which there is the time to do things properly, or has the industry got tighter?
I think we've lost quite a lot in the last couple of years.
Okay.
I think we've... And levels of expectation, sadly, have... not levels of expectation, that's not the right phrase. The quality doesn't, because it's all such a rush and it's too quick, there's not too much being made, but I just feel the quality has suffered a lot because they're churning stuff out so rapidly to fill all the streaming channels that the quality and the just isn't there. There isn't the thought process gone into initially to write the scripts that are good enough, personally, I think. I've read a lot of scripts recently, and there's been one or two good ones, but there's been a lot that really I don't think are good enough to warrant spending $100 million on, or whatever the budget is. So I think I'm concerned because I think I think it's cheapening it all somehow, don't you?
Definitely. When, you know, during my formative time, it was an average time in the industry. And people would, in that time, expect to be out of work for, you know, as much as, you know, 6 months in a year. Right. This is no reflection on their talent. It was just to do with timing and the availability of jobs. As a result, I think, I wouldn't say we tried hard, I don't mean that at all, but I think you were given time to actually learn your trade.
Mm.
And not sadly, but the situation we find ourselves in now is that the manpower that's required to service all these projects, it's just crying out for people, not off the street, but, you know, with very little experience, they find themselves in you know, positions of responsibility. And that's not fair on them. And I think that's one of the slightly difficult situations we find ourselves in. I know that as a person that would need to put a crew together for a production designer on a show, it's a bit fingers crossed and hold your breath to the, you know, the sort of people you can get to do them. And the reality is the camera doesn't know any of these stories. When the camera turns up, it expects to film immaculate sets.
Mm.
Doesn't need to know that we've been working day and night for 2 weeks without, you know, a wink of sleep to get it done, and the paint's only just dry. The fact is the camera goes, oh, this is a bit average. And that's the thing we must always not let happen.
That's a beautiful phrase, though, the camera doesn't know these sort of sets.
You know, literally, go outside and their chip is hanging in rags. You know, the production designer's literally, you know, going into a coma because we've just got it there. And the camera goes, yeah, good, we'll be out there by lunchtime. And that's an interesting, you know, it's a thing we always must remember.
You're exactly right, Peter, because everyone works so hard to produce that what you see on the camera. And if that isn't good enough, then that's a reflection on the whole film as well. It's not just a reflection on the designer or the director, whatever. It reflects the whole film because the quality has to be there on the screen. Because once it's on the celluloid or the digital now, that's on there forever. So you've got to get it right.
So what's the solution, or what's the, you know, what's the model for going forward in a healthier way?
I think the genie's out of the bottle to a degree.
Yeah,
no freelance filmmaker is going to go, cool, there shouldn't be so many films being made. Of course not. Or we shouldn't be building all these new studios. Of course we must. We need to expand to keep our position in that wave of new productions. I just think that it probably falls on, to a degree, people like our art directors and me to actually do a sort of a lot more quality control about how the documentation and how that sort of stuff is produced.
Do we need more apprenticeships? Do we need more training?
That's been something that's been mooted on and off for a long time. Certainly in my lifetime, we've gone from absolutely no form of education to service the art department to some quite, not second rate, but some very basic courses. Now we have several colleges that do provide excellent, excellent courses.
But it always used to be that you would learn on the job.
Yeah,
you
know, basically.
You come in with a certain skills level, whether you've either you have done a course in architecture or interior design, or you've worked your way up from school, and that was great because you really do. I still say one of the two best jobs in the art department: art department assistant and production designer. They're the two extremes. An art department assistant. I did several years as an art department assistant, and I loved every minute.
And what does that involve?
It's basically you're the tea boy. You start making the tea, and you end up you're printing drawings. You're going around. You're delivering drawings to every department on the film. You get to see every aspect of filmmaking. You get into every office. Mm. You get to know all the production people. You get to know all the construction, special effects, everybody. And you just see it all going on, and you're in it all day long. You go on set, and they're filming. And you're going, wow! I remember being on Alien 3 and walking in, and there was just this on 007 stage, this huge the furnace at the end, and just I would stay behind it. You know, they were shooting 24 hours a day more or less, but I would walk in and I would just hang around on the back of the set just watching it all, being in absolute total awe of this, you know. And I saw that going on, and you know, the bits in between, you're more office bound quite often, unless you're an art director around and about, but you know, you learn your craft, you learn, and then you learn your technical drawing, you learn how to draw, and I'm still very big on pencil drawing. I'm not a computer drawing person. I'm not, because you know, we had these amazing technicians, didn't we? Jim Morahan and Mike Boone and everybody who drew. You could always tell whose drawing it was because the style and the film drawings were a piece of art in themselves.
Yeah,
they were
beautiful.
So you saw that sort of thing, you know, and so I think that for me was a great training. I went to Kingston the year before, actually did the film and TV design course, which was great as an introduction. Fantastic. But it was when I finally got my first job, which was on a film called The Rainbow Thief, actually, with Omar Sharif. Just walking onto the stage, that smell of the paint. It's just, it's fantastic. Absolutely amazing.
So does that still happen, the thrill of, you know, the smell of the paint? It's like a theatrical thing of what you're talking about. It's like when people talk about lifetime in theatre, they will literally talk about...
Yeah, it is. I still get a buzz walking onto the stage.
You're completely addicted.
Yeah, you have to be, I think.
Well, of course you're up and out of date. I mean, for goodness sake. You know, we are paid money to create magic. You know, I mean, at the moment, you know, someone's going into work to create a Bond lair on a Monday, or a pirate ship, spaceship, or an old little bedroom somewhere. I mean, where are you going to get that sort of mess?
And every job, every day's different, every job's different, every script's different, and that's what's so exciting about it. But what I found recently, which is very strange, is people say, oh, it was always be that you'd try and do as a diverse range of films as you could, because it's always good to do something different. Now they're saying, oh, you haven't done there was something I got for him. Oh, well, he hasn't got the credits in, hasn't got credit for that kind of film. And I'm like, well, we can do anything. That's the whole point. You know, we want to do everything, and you do sometimes get a name for doing a certain type of thing,
yeah,
don't
of course.
You? But you still get the buzz.
Okay, do you have to have that? Because you said, like, if we didn't have it, what would we be doing? Do you have to have that kind of addiction to it to do it well?
I don't know. I'm just very enthusiastic about it. Maybe. I don't know. Sometimes. I think what you get is you get a whole range of personalities in the art department, and you need different people with different skills and different approaches to it, don't you? That's what's one of the other things that's great about it. You get such a broad skill base.
Yeah.
People coming in. Somebody asked me this question last year. Somebody said, I'm not great at technical drawing. What do you think? I said, well. You have another skill that you can bring. You might be great at graphics, you might be great at model making, you might be great at dressing a set. Everyone has a different skill, and that's the other great thing, is that you have all these people with these different skills that come together and produce something. You do a film called Mindhorn, you know, we spent a week just making...
Isle of Man, Mindhorn.
It was the Isle of Man. Yeah. And we had a couple of art department assistants in there for a week just painting silly masks, you know, because we had this parade where everyone has to wear these silly masks. So, you know, it's every job's different.
Did you know that Mindhorn is the first film shot and set in the Isle of Man since George Formby's No Limits? I say this because my family's mates, they're from the Isle of Man. Loads and loads of films are shot in the Isle of Man, but none of them are set in the Isle of Man. And Mindhorn is the first one that's actually set there.
We're quite proud of it.
Yeah, it's really funny. And it's got everything. It's got Laxi Wheel, it's got all the stuff that you want. So, from both of you, when you look at your careers, what are the things that stand out? What are you most proud of? What are the films that you're most proud of having worked on?
Oh, that's a hard one, and it sounds like, you know, it's like, oh, but it really is hard. For me personally, I think the background to the set is almost as important as the end set. You know, there would be physical challenges, time challenges, conceptual challenges that made it a special moment. And you can never make a set that you don't love. You know, you always make it your own. If you really, really needed, you know, a one sentence answer, and it's I'd probably say the one that was most challenging but most enjoyable, that I had the most fun on, and the product was okay, was a Ridley Scott film called White Squall. And I was part of the department I was working in, we built the boat in Malta that did all of that.
Yeah.
Brilliantly helped by the special effects, but we worked very closely together, almost in isolation, because the main unit were out on location and doing all sorts of other things, and quietly there we were in Malta sort of making this thing. And it was just it started out well, it was well executed, and it filmed well. And there were no hiccups, no problems, no typhoons, nothing. And for me, that was one of the highlights, I think.
Yeah. And I think that scene, the capsizing scene in White Squall, is one of the most remarkable pieces of Ridley cinema. And I interviewed him about that film shortly afterwards, because it found it quite hard to get an audience. And he said it was one of the films he felt most personal about, because he felt it was about that kind of boys to men transition, which meant such a lot to
him.
But that sequence is...
But, you know, in its time, already technology has moved on. So we would definitely not be doing it exactly the way we did it there.
Yeah.
You know, and it
still holds up, though. I bet you that it still holds up now.
But, I mean, you know, anything in front of Ridley and he'll make it work. It's quite clever.
Okay, that's a great answer. What about you? What are you most proud of?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm proud of The Father, because that was a real challenge, because it was one of those jobs where, you know, you get the script and you have to read the script four times before you really understand what's going on. And the physical challenges of that job were immense, and the money and timescale. We had seven. I started and we stopped. From the day I started to the day we started shooting was 7 weeks. So I not only had to design it, we had to get the thing built and get it all dressed. So that was, I'm very proud of that. I am obviously proud of that film. But then again, you know, when I look back and I think about some of the amazing experiences I've had, I think standing on the burn in Mexico on Titanic, watching the set go down and listening to the first AD say, set going down, and literally watching the two-thirds section of the ship descend into a tank of water was incredible. I mean, it was just Peter Lamont was the production designer, amazingly ridiculous scale, and just every set you went onto was just like, wow, this is absolute another hairs on the back of your neck standing up. It was incredible. And you know, some of those Bond films are great, aren't they? We did the Casino Royale. We did all the bit in the Bahamas and the. It was Madagascar, Bahamas, yeah. And also the Bahamas for real. I mean, that was great. And then went to Lake Como for the Italian bits at the end, which was fantastic. Venice was fantastic. And so, yeah, you know, travelling around the world was amazing and seeing all these fantastic places. But yeah, proud also, too, what else I'm really proud of. Two little short films I did, one called The Phone Call with Sally Hawkins. We did that for no money at all. That was a... To see that come to fruition from, you know, a two-day shoot in a warehouse, an old factory up in Tottenham. And then another tiny one, which was called Room 8, which was a really small little film, which won the BAFTA, which was really clever script again. And I think that's the thing for me as well, though, is the script has to have something, has to offer something really exciting and challenging to start with. That's the hard part, finding the script that really makes you go, wow, this could be really interesting. That's where The Father stood up. That's where the short films have stood up as well.
Last question to both of you. Do you think the future of the industry is positive, or do you think we are in a particularly challenging time? Because we've just come through two very difficult years. Is the future...
Without a doubt, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I can see... The growth of the younger members of the art department, helped to a degree by having some older heads around, I can see them carrying us forward.
Yeah.
Now, the industry will change. I won't, you know, in 8, 9, 10 years, I won't recognise where we are. But I know that I think we're very, very well equipped to actually move forward with a certain amount of style. Yeah.
I think it's moved so quickly in the last 5 years. Technology's moved on at record-breaking speed, and visual effects has become such a huge aspect of every film, even the small ones now, you know, all the clean-up stuff they do. But I think, as long as we can nurture the talent we've got coming up through, and just I think you bide your... it's about biding your time and learning your craft. That's what we've got to instill in people, because I just worry that... If there's because there's such a lot of work around, and as you were saying, Peter, there's a huge influx of new talent being escalated quite quickly, and there's nothing wrong with taking your time and understanding how a film works, and learning and loving the craft, because it's still a craft. It used to be a cottage industry. It's now a multi-million pound industry, and even Boris Johnson talks about it. I mean, it's like, you know, suddenly it's become such a huge economic factor in the country. So it's but yeah, it's always positive, and I think we've got to keep positive, but I think we've just got to remind people, just learn your craft, because there's so much to learn. Mm-hmm. And don't let visual effects take over and just do it all completely, because so much in camera, you know, we've done films where you've done foreground miniatures and cut half full-size cutouts. Fantastic, you know, and they work, and they don't need to then spend
and they don't
trillions
age,
on
and they don't
and
age.
They don't age and they look
physical doesn't age.
No, it's definitely so. Yeah, positive, but we've all just got to enjoy it and just learn the craft. That's the thing.
You've been listening to a Kermit on Film special about the BFDG, the British Film Designers Guild, and their annual Production Design Awards. Our guests were Blair Barnett, currently Vice Chair and soon to be Chair of the British Film Designers Guild, and nominated for Best Production Design Short Film for her work as production designer and set decorator on the short films All These Men That I've Done and Scrappy Cat. Lily Lee Abraham, who won the award for Best Production Design Short Film for her work as production designer and set decorator on Catch a Butcher. Peter Francis won the award for Best Production Design in Independent Feature Film Contemporary for his work on The Father. Peter Russell was given the Lifetime Achievement Award this year and also won the award for Best Production Design International TV Drama, including miniseries, TV movie or limited series, as supervising art director on The Nevers. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. To find out more about the BFDG, visit britishfilmdesigners.com/awards. Stay safe. Keep watching the skies.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.